the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
What is the true value of Bitcoin? It's currently trading between 1.1 million rand and 1.4 million rand. So I guess it's fair to say that is what the market values it at. Like gold, it produces no revenue, earnings, or dividends. So how do we establish its true value? There are those, and to be fair, their numbers are declining, who say that it is worth nothing at all. On the other side are those who say we are witnessing the greatest monetary revolution in history. Bitcoin is fully digital. There's no central issuing authority. It's decentralized and has never been successfully hacked. That's quite a track record. Michael Saylor, the founder of New York Stock Exchange-listed data analytics company MicroStrategy, has been a fierce advocate for Bitcoin for many of the reasons just stated. He pumps all of the company's reserve cash into Bitcoin and has borrowed massively to accumulate more than 214,000 Bitcoin. He's bet big on this monetary revolution, and his company share prices outperformed most of the tech darlings on the New York Stock Exchange, even rivaling Nvidia, which is riding, of course, the AI wave. If that's the case, why haven't other companies been as aggressive in backing Bitcoin? MicroStrategy clearly has a huge tolerance for volatility that others don't. But then it comes back to the question other treasury managers are asking, how do you value it? Well, to help us answer that question, we're joined by Rob Price of Sound Money Capital. Rob, good to talk to you again. You recently wrote an article on this very subject about MicroStrategy and how it has outperformed other tech firms precisely because it invests so massively in Bitcoin. The founder, Michael Saylor, has been criticized, widely criticized for this, especially during the Bitcoin bear market. But of course, those criticisms seem less strident these days. You then ask the question, why more companies are not following his example? In other words, going long Bitcoin and short fiat. Do you see this as a smart strategy, or is it just too risky for most corporations?
Thanks, Kieran. Great to be here with you. I think it's all about how you define risk. You know, if you think about risk as being different to consensus, then, you know, MicroStrategy's decision is risky. If you think about risk purely in volatility terms, then, you know, the decision can also seem a little risky. But if you consider that the monetary and fiscal instability that we're dealing with in the world today, and they're both rising, then perhaps, you know, MicroStrategy's decision mitigates or manages against the risk that we're seeing. You know, no centrally controlled currency has ever lasted forever, and government debts are continuing to rise unabated, and they clearly, those centrally issued currencies are losing their value versus scarce assets. So it doesn't make sense to store your value over long periods of time in cash or bonds. Of course, we also have alternatives in, you know, equity and property, but perhaps those also have their own vagaries and challenges. Valuations are not necessarily great, and they are certainly not pure store of value or monetary assets. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin is the advent of digital scarcity. It brings money into the digital age, and it's the best long-term store of value we've ever seen, and it's still an under-owned asset. So from that respect, it's potentially a risk management decision. But as I said, it all depends on how you define risk and what the treasury management process is at the company.
I mean, the people that I've spoken to in the corporate world, a lot of them privately, you know, at the very senior levels, own Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But they won't adopt the same strategy for their company because it just doesn't pass, you know, the risk assessment committee, I guess. Now, Michael Saylor is obviously taking a bet that Bitcoin is headed to the stars. And I mentioned in the beginning that he was severely criticized during the Bitcoin bear market. But now, of course, he looks like an absolute star. If you're taking a 10-year view, do you think it's a smart strategy?
Yes, I do think it's a smart strategy for exactly the reasons that I've outlined. That over a long period of time, you know, fiat currencies are devaluing. There's a risk of a monetary regime change. You know, the current monetary regime has, you know, lasted for approximately 50 years. It's creaking with debt and interest rate levels. And so there's a heightened possibility of a change. I think the other thing that's potentially worth noting, Kieran, is, you know, MicroStrategy's corporate structure is probably slightly different to many others. So as you've mentioned, there's lots of supporters of Bitcoin and crypto assets in companies, but they potentially don't have as much control within those companies. Whereas MicroStrategy, you know, Michael Saylor, he is the largest individual shareholder of the company, and he is, you know, a CEO and a member of the board and holds significant influence in governance and the direction of strategy. So in that respect, there obviously are other companies that are like that, but they aren't as common. And so I just think it will take longer for you know, the bigger boards to get a majority of supporters. And once that clicks over into a majority, then you could start to see more adoption in treasury balance sheets.
All right. That leads us to the question that a lot of these corporate executives are asking is, how exactly do you value Bitcoin? It's got no earnings. It's got no revenue. It doesn't pay dividends. How do you value it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Kieran. And I think it's also important to note that in a sense, we actually have already answered it in this conversation. You know, Bitcoin is a scarce, digital, decentralized asset that was created at a time when existing monetary system is under pressure. And that implies that it is incredibly invaluable. But I know what you're referring to here is kind of almost more quantitative methods to assess whether Bitcoin at the specific point in time is over and undervalued. And as you mentioned, obviously, the lack of earnings and dividends or revenues implies that, you know, Bitcoin cannot be valued by traditional measures that we would use to value bonds and equities and properties like dividend yields, cap yields, or earnings yields, that type of thing. And it's also interesting to note at that point that that's a clear reason why many investors, particularly those with strong traditional backgrounds, don't like Bitcoin, because it doesn't fit neatly into their valuation models and their worldview. It doesn't just, you know, it doesn't fit the process. But yeah, there are a number of measures that can be used. And here are, you know, four ones that we can touch on briefly or as much detail as you like. But one would be, you know, comparing Bitcoin to alternatives. So, you know, Bitcoin is this alternative store of value. What other assets are similar? Gold could be offered as an alternative. If Bitcoin's market cap were to rival something like gold, what would that imply for the size of Bitcoin and therefore the price of Bitcoin? So you can go through that type of valuation metric. It would spit out, you know, Bitcoin price in the region of $500,000. And that's of interest, right? It provides some sort of comparison. You can see the logic, but there's obviously also downsides. You have no idea how long that's going to take place over. Should Bitcoin only be compared to gold? Well, potentially not, right? Because there are lots of other store of value assets in the world, you know, global bond markets, global property markets also, you know, function as a store of value. So, you know, Bitcoin could be far higher than that, but also we don't know exactly the time horizon. So interesting valuation metric, but of course not perfect. Another one would be looking at something like production cost. You know, Bitcoin miners, that they are the ones that you know, essentially, you know, produce new Bitcoin, or they get rewarded for new Bitcoin when they you know, produce new blocks of transactions. But yes, they use electricity and computer processing power as their inputs. And so you can kind of estimate what the production cost of each Bitcoin is. Now, I don't think that's a perfect valuation metric. Most of the time, Bitcoin trades at higher price than its production cost, but it is an interesting metric in terms of it provides a pseudo floor on the price, similar to how the gold price doesn't for long periods of time fall below its production cost. And that's actually quite interesting. It's relevant at the moment in connection to the halving, which recently took place, which saw the daily supply issuance of Bitcoin get cut in half. And that has an impact on Bitcoin's production cost. It actually, it almost doubles it overnight, because you've got these miners that are still allocating the same inputs, but they're only getting rewarded with half the amount of Bitcoin. Now, like all valuation metrics, it's not like Bitcoin's price is going to go towards that valuation metric over any, you know, short period of time. But it does, in some sense, provide a higher floor price for Bitcoin. And that's why, you know, from my perspective, you know, the halving is still a relevant event, less relevant probably with each subsequent halving, because the that actual new daily issuance, well, it's smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's also smaller relative to a larger market cap and more daily traded volume. But nevertheless, the fact that it has an impact on the floor price of Bitcoin, I think, you know, means that it remains important. And then a couple of other things that, of course, we can look at, and there's a host of other potentials, but looking at the valuation of the dollar, right? If you know, if Bitcoin is an alternative monetary network, then you can compare it to the existing one, and then there might be times when the dollar is being protected better by the Federal Reserve and central bankers, where, you know, positive real interest rates, a stronger dollar, tighter money supply growth, these type of things will tend to suggest that the dollar valuation is more attractive, and of course, vice versa. And that's also, once again, it's relevant to compare what does the world look like at the moment. And, you know, just anecdotally, we are now seeing an increase in money supply growth again. So that tends to suggest we're in a period of challenges for the dollar. It doesn't necessarily mean the dollar itself is going to weaken, but store of value assets and you know, assets like Bitcoin can benefit, of course, when liquidity is being pushed into financial markets. And then the last one I just touch on briefly is looking at the underlying metrics within the Bitcoin market itself. You can use that to assess, you know, the valuation of Bitcoin. There are times when Bitcoin holders, long-term holders, hold a significant portion of supply, and that tends to suggest that Bitcoin itself is undervalued because those long-term holders tend to be quite knowledgeable about the network, right? They've been in it for a long period of time. And so when they hold a significant portion of supply, that tends to suggest an attractive outlook over the next 12, 18, 24 months. And of course, vice versa being the case when, you know, Bitcoin holders, long-term holders are selling down a significant portion of their holdings, that tends to suggest a less constructive outlook for price. So that just gives you I can send through an article where you can go through the data here, but these are all quantitative methods where one can use to get a handle on the potential for price growth over, you know, 12, 18, 24 months' time.
I see that CoinShares.com, they bring out this mining report every quarter or every half year or so. They currently put the cost of mining Bitcoin at about $38,000. Now, the price today is around about $62,000. So, you know, the price is well above. There's good margins, good gross margins on the actual cost of mining. But this is post the halving. Now, the halving has just happened in April, and you might just want to touch on that and the impact that's going to have on the Bitcoin price going forward from here. One would expect that when you've got a reduced supply and demand remains the same, that you would see an increase in the price. Then, of course, you've got the licensing of Bitcoin ETFs in the United States. There was an initial buying frenzy from these newly licensed exchange-traded funds. And the Bitcoin price since then has softened a bit. There's been a bit of selling. Just give us a bit of a breakdown. What's happening at the moment in the market?
Yeah, so I mean, I won't repeat myself too much on the halving front and the Bitcoin production cost, but that is the impact for me from the halving is that the production cost of Bitcoin does increase post the halving because miners are still allocating a similar amount of electricity and computer processing power, but they're receiving half the amount of Bitcoin. That should increase the floor price of Bitcoin over time and have some positive impact on price at some point in time. And I think it's really important to remember that your more high probability valuation metrics tend to have less relationship with price over short periods of time, whereas metrics that have some sort of value over very short periods of time, they tend to actually not be valuation metrics at all. I mean, that actually is the case in traditional financial markets too. So that touches on the halving. In terms of the ETFs, I mean, we saw a big wave of flows into the market. You know, it's obviously pushed up price. You know, we could certainly see another wave of flows, you know, in the future. But of course, that, you know, they're not going to come, you know, all in a linear fashion. Speaking about, you know, the market kind of at the current juncture, well, we're at a little, there are a number of different factors to take into account. But I think the summary here is that you have seen some profit taking from long-term holders at new all-time highs that is having a somewhat of a softening impact on price. Those long-term holders, while they have sold down on holdings, still hold a significant portion of supply. So that makes us, you know, pretty confident that the bull market is still intact. You're more likely to see higher prices in 12, 18, 20 more, 24 months' time. But as I said, that selling pressure is having a softening impact on price in the short term. And then also just to note that in traditional financial markets, while, as I mentioned, the trend is toward a better liquidity outcome over the next 12, 18 months' time, you have seen a slight increase you know, in the dollar more recently, a slight reduction in global risk appetite across the board. You also have seen an increase in the correlation between Bitcoin and equity markets. And therefore, Bitcoin is at this current juncture trading a little bit more like a risk on, risk off asset. So when global risk appetite moderates somewhat, as it has over the last month or so, that does have a softening impact on price. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, the outlook is very constructive, I think, still over 12, 18, 24-month time horizon. But there are, you know, some headwinds that we're just working through in the market over a shorter-term time horizon.
Let's turn for a minute to the retail investor. A lot of people, with every jump in price that you get or every bull market you have in Bitcoin, you get a new wave of adopters. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are saying, they don't know how to get into it. The price has gone too high. They do compare it to an asset like a Tesla share or an Nvidia share or something like that. What's your advice to them? Is it too late for them?
No, I don't think so. I think the major advice here is to pull back the lens. We are potentially in the midst of a monetary regime change. The current monetary system is breaking and doesn't work for many people. Bitcoin is the intersection of three very powerful trends: digitization, a demographic shift towards younger people who tend to be more, you know, favorable towards digital assets than older generation, and then, of course, the monetary trend that we've covered extensively. And the asset is still significantly under-owned globally if you look at those numbers. So, you know, I don't think it's a good idea to look at just the price level alone, because that argument that you made about price being high could have been made at most points in Bitcoin's history, right? It has seen exponential growth in price. So, you know, even if you were buying in, you know, 2016 or 2017, the same argument would have been the same. You know, the price is at $1,000, but it's come up from $1, so it looks expensive. But if you pull back the lens, you think about the monetary regime change risks, you think about the impact that this asset has had on portfolios, even if you just made a small allocation, it's incredibly powerful. And as I've also mentioned, is that while many people see it as a way to almost dial up risk in their portfolio, I would caution against that type of approach, because if you think about the risk of a monetary regime change, Bitcoin can be a risk management tool against that outcome. And if you look at the back-tested data, just small allocations can have a positive impact on risk-adjusted returns. So what does that mean? That means impacting the performance of a portfolio, but having very little impact on actual volatility and drawdowns, right? Because you've got, yes, a volatile asset, but it's only a small component of your total portfolio. So anyway, critically, it's important to have a long-term outlook when making that decision. And that's often what's tricky for people, right? They get in and they want to see results over a three-month horizon or a six-month horizon. Ideally, you really need to be looking, you know, 4 years out, 5 years out, position size it appropriately so that you can weather the volatility.
Finally, Rob, is there a danger that big institutional money pouring into these Bitcoin ETFs will lead to centralization? In other words, a few investors controlling the market. One of the problems that's been identified is that several of these ETFs have turned to Coinbase to custody their assets. Now, are there potential dangers in that?
Yes, there are. I think that greater centralization risk is something always to be cognizant of in Bitcoin. And if you do see dramatic growth in the US-based ETFs and the custodians all remain with Coinbase, that does create some degree of centralization risk. It's important to note that that is still very low at this stage. While I'm talking about the risk, I don't think it's a major issue. Even if it were to get up to a much higher level, it still doesn't necessarily, it doesn't impact actually the security of Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis. That is not something that I'm concerned about. But what it could imply is that just that institution could have a greater kind of influence over Bitcoin improvement protocols and proposals in the future. And so that's just something that is not ideal and we need to be cognizant of and vigilant against. But the way I see it is that, one, as I said, we're a long way from that point. Even though we've seen dramatic growth in the ETFs, there's still a very small proportion of the total Bitcoin market. And even if we were to grow up to much higher levels, then I assume that people would start to diversify the custodians and not have all of those ETFs custody their assets with the same institution.
And finally, Rob, just explain Sound Money Capital. What do you do?
Sound Money Capital is an actively managed digital asset fund for high net worths and family offices. And we can't speak about too many details because we are a private fund here in primarily based in the US and Delaware. Obviously, if anybody wants to know more about what we do, they can find us on our website, find me on LinkedIn or anything like that. Happy to answer any questions on a individual basis. But the high level also answer to that question is, obviously I've explained some of the specifics there in terms of an actively managed solution for high net worth clients and family offices. But also we just support people in their understanding of this asset class, allocating towards it prudently and effectively so they can have a positive experience. And so many people in my network have had a positive experience, but some of them have had a negative experience because they've been negatively impacted by the vagaries of volatility.
Fantastic. We're going to leave it there. That was Rob Price, who is the founder and chief executive of Sound Money Capital. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Kieran. Great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.